When it comes to heat stress, our first line of defense is going to be those heat abatement and management strategies like cooling with fans or sprinklers, things like that. But nutrition can also play a role, and it's kind of our second line of defense against heat stress.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Adiseo USA, producers of Smartamine M and MilkPay.com.
Well, welcome to the Dairy Podcast. Today's special episode is brought to you in partnership by Wyzenetics and Adiseo. I'm Katie Besch. I'm a dairy technical manager with Adiseo, based in the Midwest, but working with our customers and dairy producers across the country. I'll be serving as your host today, bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the dairy industry. Get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode, looking at breaking the heat stress cycle. My guest today is Dr. Ximena Laporta. Dr. Laporta is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. As a lactation physiologist, her research program focuses on how environmental and nutritional factors affect mammary development and lifetime performance in dairy cattle. Ximena, I know you have been on the pod before, so welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
Good to have you. My other co-host slash expert guest today joining us on the podcast is Dr. Danielle Sherlock. Danielle is the Ruminant Innovation and Customer Success Manager here at Adiseo with me. Specializing in nutritional physiology, she develops sustainable solutions that optimize ruminant health, performance, and long-term customer success. Danielle, you are also an alum of the Dairy Pod, so welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be here again today.
I know. I'm the new one joining you guys, longtime listener, first-time caller to the Dairy Podcast, so thank you for letting me join you today. So today we will be focusing on heat stress and kind of how that impacts the calf and the future generations. Dr. Laporta has a bunch of very interesting research in this area. But Danielle, some of your research has also been in heat stress. And I don't know if you wanted to start with a few quick comments. What does heat stress mean to the dairy industry? Why are we interested in this space? I know here in the Midwest, it's a little bit warmer at my house than it is at your house, but I'm already hot, so I'm sure the cows are hot. What does that mean for us?
Yeah, happy to introduce a little bit of the topic. You know, heat stress is no longer just a regional or seasonal issue, but really a growing global challenge as we experience more and more hot days. Not only do we see the short-term impacts in terms of that drop in intake, milk production, decreases in repro, for example, but we're learning a lot about the long-term impacts affecting multiple generations. And I think we're going to talk a lot about that today and Dr. Laporta's work in that area. And when it comes to heat stress, our first line of defense is going to be those heat abatement and management strategies like cooling with fans or sprinklers, things like that. But nutrition can also play a role, and it's kind of our second line of defense against heat stress. And so that's kind of how we started thinking about heat stress at Adiseo, and could we use nutrition to break the cycle of these generational effects of heat stress? And we've done some research in the past at the University of Illinois, but as you, the listeners, will hear today, we've also done a lot with Dr. Laporta at UW the last few years.
Yeah, very good, which it leads us right into. So Ximena, like Danielle mentioned, this has been a long-term project you've been working on, research across the country, test subjects across the country that just travel with you to your different universities. And I know that on your previous podcast episode, if anybody wants to check it out, it was episode 70, Managing Heat Stress in Dairy. You kind of gave the overview of most of your research research program at that time, but do you want to give us a quick highlight on some of those heat stress impacts, what you've been looking at for the cow or for her calf?
Yes, thank you. Sure. So as you mentioned, Katie, we have a recent episode, and the main highlight of the first part of the episode was sort of highlighting that change in the way we approach heat stress. I think for many, many years, we have been thinking about heat stress and the cost related to heat stress in our dairies, mostly related to those effects that we see in lactating cows that affect the farmer right away, the bottom line in terms of fertility, milk production, intake of those cows, and things like that. We're all well aware of that, and we can see it. Now, I think the landscape is changing a little bit, and we now know that that's only part of the story, and there's a lot more to heat stress than lactating cows. There's more to heat stress than the summer months, and that's kind of the focus of my research, you know, kind of looking at what are the hidden effects of heat stress that we don't see right away, but it can really affect the bottom line survival and productivity of not just the lactating cow, but also the dry cow that it's pregnant and is developing the future replacement. So those daughters that you were referring to. So I think that the first part of that podcast sort of focused on that, summarizing the research we have been doing and focusing on the losses of the dry cows in their next lactation and adding that up with the losses in the daughters. I think in a nutshell, we now know that daughters from heat stress cows during late gestation are going to be less productive, less healthy. They're going to leave the herd sooner. There's a host of impacts on those animals that show up later in the game, years down the road. And I think we have to start thinking about heat stress with that mindset, more of an investment, not just in our lactating cows. We 100% need to continue to do that, whether it's nutritionally or with cooling, heat abatement through cooling, mechanical cooling, but thinking also of all the other impacts that it has on the herd as a whole.
Adesayo, a global leader in nutritional solutions and the provider of SmartAmine M, the best-in-class rumen-protected methionine product for dairy producers who want to optimize milk production, capture more value from their components, and maintain the lifetime performance of their herds. For more product information and to calculate your return on investment when you balance your feed with amino acids, go to milkpay.com.
Exactly. Great point. And just in case anyone listening is not familiar with the original setup of the experiment, so the only heat stress insult was on those original dams, the transition cows during their dry period, right?
Yeah. So the these are control studies that we did in Florida in collaboration with Dr. Dahl. So we have what we call like late gestation heat stress model, where we have pregnant cows, pregnant dry cows, where in the last 49, 50 days of their gestation, whether provide heat abatement through cooling, through evaporative cooling, or we let them be summer, hot, humid summer in Florida. So our control is the heat stress cow. So we're trying to that those heifers that are developing in utero are gestated under thermoneutral conditions. And so then we follow them for a lifetime and we look at the effects in their first, second, third lactation, multiple generations, and also in the dry cow herself, because that dry period is also very important for the dry cow mammary gland perspective. So there's a lot of things that are impacted in a dry cow, and I always try to bring awareness of that. That dry cow is very important, and we need to take better care of her, especially in summer.
especially during her dry period when she's gestating that calf, that next generation.
Yes.
Good reminder. And then I have actually always wondered, do you think, so the original study, when these cows were in Florida, even when they were cooled with soakers and fans, they're still in Florida, I can't get over this part. Do you think that another level of cooling, like if they had been in the upper Midwest or if the ambient temperature was even cooler, do you think your results would have been even an even greater disparity or a greater response? I'm very curious.
That's a great question, and that we always think about that and we always get that question. But it's important to know that the studies that we have done in Florida, we're talking about chronic heat stress, day, night, very little relief in that cow, sometimes at night, but mostly they are always above what the benchmarks of heat stress that we have established in dry cows and others have done in lactating cows. So they are more chronically impacted by that climate that we are all well aware of, right? In the Midwest, as you mentioned, it's very comfortable to us. Like today, it's really nice outside, but I'm getting alerts from the, I have an app, so cows are already feeling it. And it's gradual. It's not from one day to the next. So I feel like the main difference in the Midwest is that it comes very quickly. Although it's gradual, cows experience a milder temperature throughout the year. And when these temperatures start to ramp up, they can feel it and you can see it. And so we're just starting an experiment today, actually. So I'm missing the first day because I'm here. So you're welcome. But I'll be at the farm tomorrow. We're trying to answer that question for you, Katie. So maybe next podcast, I can tell you a little bit more, but we're going to have replicate a little bit of what we did in Florida now in the Midwest, particularly here in Wisconsin. As you know, there's a lot of cows here. So the impact can really be really, really big. Even if it's a short period of time, it can be really intense. And you know, the other thing that we have to think about that cows here have as an advantage is that they can cool off a little bit at night to relieve that heat stress accumulated throughout the day. So the impact is a little less intense, I would say, but they do get heat stress. They have high respiration rates above what it will be physiologically acceptable in a way. You can see cows, you can see it in fertility right away. You can see it in milk production in those lactating cows. Now the dry cow, it's always kind of like, she's more resistant, she's more resilient. And it's true, but that doesn't mean she won't be impacted. So we have some data showing even with artificially induced heat stress, we see all the hallmarks of heat stress in those animals, in their progeny. And so even mild heat stress that it's chronic and sustained over time can have these detrimental effects, not only the cow, but also in their progeny. So, you know, that sort of thought that only cows in Florida are heat stress, it's an old one. Exactly. So I hope to gather more and more data. There's a lot of data from Canada, you know, kind of similar weather to us, even a little milder in a way, showing impacts of heat stress in cows, in dry cows, lactating cows. So, you know, we have to change our mindset in that sense.
That's a great reminder. They feel the heat even when we might not quite be there. And yeah, that's makes our cooling approaches even more important. And sorry to keep you from the farm. Please apologize to your students from me. We'll look forward to the updates.
I'll be there tomorrow.
Okay. They can handle it. You've trained them well. They can manage.
I trust them.
Very good. Okay. So maybe just to highlight some of those specifics, the lasting carryover effects that you did mention, the dam is heat stressed during her dry period. We know she decreases milk during the next lactation. We know her daughters, when they calve 2 years later, have decreased production. What do some of those numbers look like maybe, or how long is this carryover effect lasting?
Yeah, so from the data that we have, we've seen detriments to the first lactation, the second lactation, and even the third lactation. So the first lactation, okay, I buy it. But the when we start seeing the second and third lactation, then that's where we start wondering, like, what is this really in utero heat stress doing to that animal and impacting for that long term? So I think we have to go back to that in utero effect and think of what's happening in the development of that heifer. Of course, I always say the heifer is fully formed. She has all four legs, you know, two eyes and everything, but their organ systems are still maturing and still developing, and they are very sensitive to the environment, so the maternal environment, and so they rely on maternal regulation of temperature to regulate their own temperature. So if the mom is heat stressed, they are going to be heat stressed in utero. And so that thermal difference in utero is communicating, it's talking to the cells and it's saying, hey, it's hot in here, right? And so that is changing the way cells read their environment and is putting, I like to explain it as it's putting some holes into proliferation. This is something that a growing animal is experiencing in all their tissues. They're growing, they're maturing, they're differentiating into their cell types. And so when they sense this harsh environment, they're going to say, hey, we need to change our trajectory. We need to stop. It's going to be awful outside, you know. And so they are adapting to their environment. And that's I personally think of it as a good thing, right? And that's how they are going to be experiencing their environment when they are born. And so I think our research have shown that these heifers are born structurally different, right? So they are smaller, they have impairments in efficiency of absorption. We have shown that all over in all our studies, but we're have gone on to show that their organ systems are not performing as they should. So they, I don't know, meant to mention a few, of course, the mammary gland is the one I have spent more time researching on, but they start their lives with smaller potential, with smaller tissues, giving them less potential to grow. Their liver metabolism is impaired. Even their sweat glands work differently if they were in utero heat stress. Their adrenal glands are larger because they are stressed in utero. So that adrenal gland is working harder. So you wonder how will that impact the way she thermoregulates later in life. So we have looked at a lot of things, including the placenta. There's a lot of great work now from Florida showing impairments in placental development. And so the placenta is the nexus between the cow and the fetus. So you know, nutrient availability to that fetus and so on. I can keep talking forever, but sure. the point here is that those differences that we see two, three, 4 years down the road is because they start life as a different animal with different tools. Mm-hmm. And the fascinating part to me is that a 6 week period can do that to an animal, right? We're talking about heat stress, but there are other stressors. And when you think of us humans and wonder what my mom was doing when she was pregnant, right? and things like that. But that's a concept. And of course, the other point is early life, right? It's not just in utero. That's very, very important. But also the first few months of life, the environment that we provide to these animals, it's critical. And I think that that mindset is shifting a little bit. We now know that what we do early in life can have these effects, and I'm proud to see this research being showcased, because it's important to link that early life with long life performance. So that's what we're trying to do here. It's challenging, but
yeah, that's a great reminder that some of these small changes we make today, if the cow is exposed to heat stress, or if we do provide cooling or other measures to alleviate some of that heat load burden, that we can really change her trajectory, and not just for her, but her daughters, her granddaughters. And yeah, sometimes I think, like you said, if, you know, I'm struggling with something or I'm not quite happy with how something goes, I'm like, is this my mom's fault? Is this my grandmother's fault? Have they set me up for this?
Yeah, your grandmother, you know.
What was she up to?
Maybe it's her fault, but...
No, she was a strong lady. She set me up well. She was a strong lady. Very good. Jimena, you also mentioned something curious that I've thought about, a difference in the sweat glands, or maybe how these calves thermoregulate. Do you think that's a completely separate adaptation, or does that make sense, like if we think there's changes in the mammary gland and those tissues kind of arise from this the same origin, right? Like get my...
Yes.
Does that make sense that those could be linked, that we are seeing these changes in the sweat glands too?
Yeah, that's a great question. And not a lot of people know that, you know, the mammary gland, it's a modified sweat gland, actually. And this is some work that I was inspired by Bob Collier. He started some of this line of work with the sweat glands and more of the serotonin story. But I think that it's fascinating. And I got into this research without knowing much about sweat gland function and how things are. And so I think that's a fascinating part of being a scientist. You get into these questions that you don't know the answers to, and you're curious and you want to explore and you want to know. And this is something that a grad student of mine, Brittany, she started wondering about these things, and we started researching on. And now it's a line of research that we're following and looking at the sweat gland, sebaceous gland, the skin adaptations, and how that might prepare them differently to thermoregulate later. So I don't remember all of the results at the top of my head, but we have looked at the sweat glands from heifers at birth, at weaning. We have looked at 1 year of age. We have looked at the granddaughters. So there's these adaptations that show up and are evident in any time that you look at those. So smaller sweat glands, deeper in the skin, in the heat stress heifers, more thinner skins. And so these are adaptations that they are going to be experiencing after they are in utero, but after they are born. So these heifers that are born to in utero heat stress moms, they are going to have higher core body temperature throughout the pre-weaning phase. So basically a 0.2 degrees Celsius. I remember that number because it was very striking to me. That's a big difference to have a core rectal temperature that it's that different between animals that you're not doing anything to them. They're, you know, they're born, we monitor them, we look at their rectal temperature, and we see that no matter what we do, they are going to have higher rectal temperatures. And so that tells me that these animals are going to be more susceptible when they encounter heat stress later. That on top of having modified sweat glands, at least structurally. In terms of function, we look at sweating rates and we have seen differences as well. Of course, this research, you know, we need to look more at the function than the structures, but the structure changes make me think that there will be functional differences. But there's a lot more to look into. And
very interesting. Yes.
Yes, but it's something that we were curious about and it ended up being super interesting.
Sure. Many areas of research to look into. We'll stay tuned. We'll look forward to seeing what you guys discover.
It's time for our famous three.
Very good. Okay, Danielle, any other questions here, maybe on the in utero heat stress or what we see in those daughters, granddaughters, great-granddaughters now, how they're impacted?
Yeah, one question I had is, you know, you've shown that not only the daughters are impacted, but even the granddaughters. And I think you had new data last year at ADSA about great-granddaughters. Was curious kind of, you know, how that's being carried out for all these generations. How are we seeing these impacts?
Yeah, so the stronger evidence we have is on the daughters. I think that we have seen it's consistent, and no matter what model we use, we see those. With the granddaughters, and the great-granddaughters, as of right now, I can tell you that heat stress insult from Florida, which is chronic, sustained over time, is leading to these generational effects. So the daughters, the granddaughters, and the great-granddaughters. Still, the question remains if a milder heat stress is going to do the same thing. So far, we have observed that more mild heat stress with an electric heat blanket still causes those daughters to produce less milk. So that was kind of rewarding to see. Not great for the cows, but you know, that even a shorter period of time in late gestation, this time it was 4 weeks that they were heat stress in utero, seeing differences in the first lactation of those daughters, to me is incredible, because I always get this question, how long it takes? Is it 6 weeks enough? Is 4 weeks? So looking at these data, it's really interesting to see that even shorter periods of time in late gestation, that's a very critical period of time in the development of those heifers. So nutritional insults, heat stress can really derail their development. So going back to the granddaughters in utero, the fetal ovary of the daughter has the germline that is going to generate that granddaughter. So of course, the granddaughter is not directly impacted. So technically, the germline that is going to become herself, it's in utero exposed. And so it's kind of interesting, because not a lot of people think about of a dry cow having multiple generations inside her, right? So her daughter and also the germline that is going to generate the granddaughters. And so an effect there can have an effect on the granddaughter as well. So we have to think about that dry cow, the daughters and the granddaughters being impacted during that time. And then the third generation or the fourth generation, however you want to see it, sometimes I think of the cow as the generation zero, the daughter as the one, granddaughter as the two, and then the great-granddaughter as the third generation. So we're starting to see some differences in these animals as well in terms of mammary physiology, sweat gland physiology. We don't have a lot of production data yet, but we still see this effects in the great-granddaughter. Now we have a subset that is starting to produce milk here in Wisconsin. That's the third cohort of the Florida cows that you mentioned earlier that I brought from UF. And so, of course, numbers are small, but it's very interesting to see this effects as well. So this is what it's called a transgenerational effect. And of course, not getting into the nitty-gritty of things, but molecularly, we see this signature in all the generations impacting common genes and pathways that are important for development and function of tissue. So it's fascinating to me. It's complex, but it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that that generation that did not experience that initial heat stress insult at all is still receiving the message from her mother, grandmother, great-grandmother.
Yes, and there's some observational data with large data sets, of course, not controlled studies. So we always have to read the papers and make sure we understand what's being done. But observational data looking at THI or the temperature humidity index that the mother was exposed to, the F0 was exposed to during gestation, during her gestation, looking at also the fourth generation. So, of course, those are not cause and effect studies. It's observational, you know, so we have to be careful with that. But it's incredible to see that the temperature humidity index during gestation can have that effect in even further generations from the great-granddaughter. So
fascinating. Great. That wraps up our overview of the generational impacts of heat stress and the effects that we can have not just on the dam, but on her daughters and on future generations. Tune in to our next episode where we highlight how can methionine rescue some of these production impacts.